All right. So am Kevin Griffin, and this is a regular Tuesday morning, at least in the Pacific time zone morning. Gathering that has been going on for the past 2 years, and I thought I would just take a moment to explain why I keep going through my books, because it occurred to me that somebody arriving here might think like this guy is like trying to promote his books or whatever, like somehow. Like, I think my books are so great, we should just read them over and over. But it's really an act of convenience for me, because when I was faced with the idea of teaching twice a week, every week, 104 times a year, I foresaw a lot of challenge for me trying to come up with a fresh topic each time. And so I kind of fell back on, oh, I know my books really well, and they will cover the material we want to talk about. So let's just do that. So it was really, I don't want to say laziness, but someone could say laziness if they were judgmental. But of course, none of you are judgmental. And I'm not judgmental, so none of us will say that. But yeah, it's just really a more convenient way. Because to me, the Dharma and recovery are just things that, there's just so many different ways to approach them and talk about them. And I just felt like all I needed was, kind of an entryway each day to get into the topic. And then we're pretty much talking about the same thing all the time anyway, right? It's not like something new. But that is, the spirit of recovery, which is one day at a time and keep coming back. It's both of those really imply that we're not trying to get somewhere. We are just trying to be here. And of course, that's a Buddhist principle as well. When if you go visit a Buddhist monastery, they chant the same chant they've been chanting for 2,500 years, every day. And so, and I'll say, having just sat a retreat that was very rich and pretty deep, the sense that what we are trying to let go of is so deeply conditioned that it's going to take a lot of work and a lot of the same work over and over, and a little chipping away or a little drop of water on the rock day by day, to maybe eventually have this breakthrough into really letting go of our what I think is fundamentally like a misperception of reality. It's a little bit of the matrix that that there's another way of seeing, there's another deeper truth that is the unconditioned reality of nirvana. And we are so deeply conditioned that it's really hard to get through all that conditioning to get to and see and be in this unconditioned place for a moment, which is how I understand the breakthrough that the Buddha talked about. So that was there's a little warm up for you. Now we will do a little bit of that chipping and dripping with our own meditation practice, which is really what we come here for, I think, at least I do. So just settle back into a comfortable posture. The body erect, as the Buddha says, but he also gives us the option of being in other postures. But the point is really to find a stable and energetic a posture. That is a posture that allows us to relax while still maintaining clarity and energy, which is really one of the great challenges as we enter into our meditation practice. So you can close your eyes or just lower your gaze, really stepping out of the external world, out of the visual world, into the felt. Experience the inner life. And even this simple action of closing the eyes and in waking hours can present a challenge. Right away, we realize that there's a world, an inner world, which is filled with feelings and thoughts, attitudes, emotions. It's not always easy to even start our meditation. Actually, probably the most difficult part of meditation is those first few minutes. So we connect with the breath as a way to ground ourselves in the body. And the breath is something that doesn't have a story, doesn't typically connect a lot with any feelings or trigger feelings. So it's kind of a neutral experience, neutral sensation. It can help us to begin this journey, turning inward, calming body, calming mind with breath. If there do seem to be any particular feelings that are very prevalent, then we can breathe with them. So we feel the breath, but we also allow ourselves to open to the emotion or mood that's present. We find this through the body, through the felt experience. And we feel the breath moving in and out. Softening the body, just letting the shoulders release. Softening the belly. Relaxing the jaw so there's no tension in the face. And continuing to be aware of the breath. There's a kind of split screen. Breath and body, breath and feeling, breath and mind. And you can perhaps point the attention at the particular sensations of breath. If you want to become more concentrated, this is typically pointing at the sensations at the nostrils, the upper lip. Since these sensations are usually quite subtle, requires kind of subtle effort to perceive them. It's hard for you to feel the breath in that area. You can just feel the movement of the belly rising and falling. Oftentimes we'll find the attention slips from the breath back into thoughts, reflections, maybe whatever you were thinking about before the class pops up, or something you've been worrying about. Or even something you'd forgotten about just appears. These thoughts can be quite compelling. And there's nothing wrong with them per se. But during meditation period, we're trying to just let go and come back to the breath, come back to the felt experience. It can be interesting just to feel that pull, that stickiness of the thoughts. we soon discover what thoughts really hold our minds, which ones are most deeply embedded of their hooks in us. This can be very revealing. We also want to be careful, though, that even these insights do not become another opportunity for more thinking. So the principle of returning to the breath is fundamental. And it really helps us to keep it simple. When the mind gets busy and complicated, Try to be patient and kind to yourself, even if the mind is busy. Gently coming back and connecting with the breath. All right. So, I don't have any special new announcements to make. We'll give the latest news, which is that we will have a retreat in Northern California in May, 5-day retreat. There's a link to the flyer in the chat. If you're interested in having a meditation retreat blended with recovery. That's all that needs to be mentioned right now. So as I mentioned, I've been going through, spent a lot of time with One Breath at a Time. And now we're looking at Burning Desire, Dharma God, and the Path of Recovery. And still in the introduction, this is, we take it slow with these books, Nowhere to go. And actually, it is, I like the introduction. I will say, and I'm probably will mention this a couple times while we're going through this book, that the woman who edited the book is named Lisa Fugard. And she was just like hired by Hay House. She wasn't an in-house editor, but she's a novelist and a really gifted writer herself. And I feel like she did really great editing on this book. Her father is Athol Fugard, the famous South African playwright. If that means anything to people. So I'm on page 5 of the, it is in the, still in the introduction. And this is actually one of my favorite parts of this book. So I'm happy to get here. I talk about this, my writing process is very much comes out of a creative writing model as opposed to a kind of research or even a like a lecture model, like a lot of Dharma books are just transcriptions of talks, and I've never been able to do that. And I love writing. But what I'm trying to say is that as I'm in this process, there's a lot of discovery that goes on for me. So this was a section definitely where kind of discovery, where I asked, as I often do as I'm writing, well, okay, here's this question. How am I going to address it? And how can I, what can I bring to this question that's real and that's authentic? Because so much sort of spiritual talk and spiritual language can get lost in sort of vague platitudes and cliches. And, so I keep kind of inquiring into these ideas that often might just sort of float by. And so here, really, this section is inquiring into the word spiritual. So I'll read a little bit of it. Actually, I might read quite a bit of it. People have asked if I think it's really necessary to believe in God to get clean and sober or to get the benefits of the 12 steps. I'm not sure. What I do think is that some kind of spiritual path or connection tremendously improves the quality of life of a person in recovery. And that quality of life has a direct impact on the ability to maintain long-term sobriety. Kind of, again, sort of a good, I think, way to think about it. The big book says that when we get sober, we aren't exactly cured, but instead have a, quote, daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. But what is our spiritual condition? Like the word God, the word spiritual is difficult to define. And just as many people are alienated by God, so too might they be turned off by spiritual. And I often hear people say, oh, I'm not a spiritual person. And I'm always curious kind of what that means to them. And I think that it is one of those things that people, as I say here, like you kind of get an idea of some sort of ethereal person. There can be a perception that if you are spiritual, you are some kind of holy person, that you go around in orange robes reciting mantras all day long, or that you never get angry, or that you don't care about money. These superficial definitions distract us from the essence of the word spiritual. The first aspect of spirituality is the understanding that happiness doesn't come primarily through the material world. And I think that that's a fairly, I think that's, I can make that argument that spiritual versus material is kind of a contrast or opposites, more or less. What's the Police song? We are spirits in the material world. This is in contrast to our culture's overemphasis on money, power, and fame. So, you know, this is like the first insight we have to have, really. And it's in order to not just get sober, I think, but to really grow into, I don't want to use the word spiritual again, into, I would say, kind of mature, whole human beings, wise human beings who are living lives that are in harmony with reality. You know, and my daughter is 23, going on 24, and, you know, and she's had a reasonable exposure to spiritual ideas, and I know she understands them, and somewhere inside her, she knows that they're true. And yet I can see that for her, and it just, I'm just using her as an example, but of young people, that there's a tendency in youth, as some of you who may have been young at one time might remember, to, you know, think that their solution is out there, right? That if I can just accomplish this, whether it's, you know, something positive, like if I become a doctor, or I come, you know, if I make a lot of money, or in my case, if you become a rock and roll star, you know, really ridiculous, or then, you know, we do it in less obvious ways. But getting high is one of them, right? Well, if I can just stay high, you know, and we're trying to fix the inner world, but through this external force. And to me, like recovery, not just sobriety and being clean, but recovery is really, you know, embraces this idea. So when we make this shift from the external to the internal, we start to emphasize integrity and a sense of wholeness that orients us towards finding what is really true, sometimes at the expense of our transient pleasure. Addiction is, of course, an attempt to sustain happiness through continuous pleasure, and it's a perfect example of the failure of this strategy. So that's a contrasting. That's really kind of talking about the definition of happiness, which is another like issue, right? I think for addicts, certainly for me, happiness meant feeling good all the time. And, you know, I've come to see happiness as something, well, what it says here is this quote from How We Choose to Be Happy, a profound, enduring feeling of contentment, capability, and centeredness. And I think of it as even more just being at ease in my life, that my life makes sense, that there aren't areas of my life that are in conflict with my values, with who I am. There aren't the shadows, you know, all of that. So that, just going back, so this first sort of element of the defining happiness is saying that defining spirituality is seeing that happiness is an inside job. A second aspect of spirituality is the recognition of our interconnectedness with other people, with nature, and ultimately with God. Well, I'd actually, if I were writing that today, I would probably leave out the part about God, because I just think it kind of confuses matters in a way when I'm kind of trying to get away from that. Our culture promotes the image of the rugged individual, the cowboy who lives alone on the plains, the heroic single mother, the self-made man, the maverick. But rather than self-actualization, what this orientation often brings is alienation, isolation, and a zero-sum competition between separate entities. The truth is, we are so deeply dependent and interrelated and related to each other that we can't take a step or have a thought without some aspect of this interconnectedness supporting us. We live in a bubble of interdependence, from the food we eat to the water we drink, the clothes we wear, our jobs, our families, our teachers. When we think we are separate, we put ourselves in constant conflict, trying to get ours, always in fear of losing what we have, alienating others whom we use for our selfish purposes, lying and cheating to make sure that we aren't left behind. This is the epitome of the addict, self-centered, fearful, and isolated. And of course, this points to something deeply deficient and just a huge failure of our culture, of American culture, of Western culture. And we see it played out every day, literally in the news, you know, in the world, and this idea of freedom being about the individual right to do anything they want, kind of, and not having responsibility to a larger community. And of course, everything from the environment taxes is influenced by this viewpoint. And so, this is, I'm calling this spiritual, but we can see that, you know, it has this direct impact on our lives. But I guess I should stay inside the lanes of recovery and spirituality here, so that we don't all blow ourselves up. The sense of interconnectedness leads to another aspect of spirituality, living by moral or ethical principles. When we recognize we are in relationship to everything and everyone, we realize that we have a responsibility to act in ways that don't harm others. Out of our exploration of our internal lives, we come to understand pain. And because we see that others suffer in the same ways we do, compassion arises. Yeah, I mean, it's really hard for me to like stay in my lane here, and, you know, reading the newspaper as I was this morning. The idea that people can intentionally go out and destroy other people's lives. Is not in harmony with these principles. Another aspect of spirituality is realizing the limits of our control over both our external and internal experience, and accepting those limits. Addicts desperately try to control how they feel through staying high. The addictive personality is one that seeks to hold everything and everyone around it under its sway. These efforts are inevitably doomed to failure, as life and the living rarely bend to our will in such ways. These are some pretty damn good turns of phrase, I will say. So let's go back and I want to read these again because I like these. Addicts desperately try to control how they feel through staying high. The addictive personality is one that seeks to hold everything and everyone around it under its sway. These efforts are inevitably doomed to failure, as life and the living rarely bend to our will in such ways. Those little balancing. With spirituality, we are oriented toward letting go, toward surrender. Rather than trying to maintain the tightly scripted life of the addict, we are open to what comes, to the ever-changing nature of life. And here we kind of start to point to what becomes, in many ways, the theme of this book, which is step three, turning our will and our lives over, and what that means, the implications of that in a from a Dharma perspective, from a Buddhist perspective. Rather than trying to maintain the tightly scripted life of the addict, we are open to what comes, to the ever-changing nature of life. And I think that's what, so step three says, we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. So if we take out him and even God, just turn our will and our lives over to life as it arises, then, you know, we're getting somewhere. In order to live by these principles, we have to have a certain amount of faith to trust that sacrificing immediate gratification for something more substantial is a worthy goal, that living with integrity and kindness is its own reward. Actually, it's much more than its own reward. That letting go and openness are ultimately freeing. It's important to distinguish this faith called sada in Buddhism from blind faith. Sada is a tested faith based on experience and wisdom. Finally, maintaining our spiritual condition then is a daily challenge. It isn't easy to look inside for happiness. It can get pretty messy in there. Interconnection puts some challenging demands on us as we suddenly have to start thinking about something other than our own self-interest. Living morally can be inconvenient. Letting go is rarely as pretty as it sounds. And fear often trumps faith in our stressful lives. Again, I remember writing this, and it's, you know, this was published in 2010. So I wrote it in probably 2008 or 9. But I remember writing this section of the book. It really stands out to me because it was a very impactful moment for me. It was a moment when I was, as I said, trying to inquire into these ideas and I don't feel that I, you know, captured every aspect of the meaning of spirituality, but I think I found some interesting ideas. And I remember getting to the end of that section and then realizing, oh wait, this all sounds good in theory, but then sort of started to ask myself, well, why is it hard? You know, well, it's hard because looking inside for happiness is difficult because it can get pretty messy in there, right? It's not always happy. Interconnection puts some challenging demands on us as we suddenly have to start thinking about something other than our own self-interest. I mean, anybody ever experienced that when they got sober and tried to work the 12th step? It's like, oh, right, there's other people. You know, and that's, of course, being married. I mean, that's, you know, the question much of the time. Or, you know, if you are so-called codependent, you know, if your tendency is to try to take care of other people, it's the flip side of this, right? All of a sudden you have to like think about, well, what does it mean to take care of me? And it can feel wrong and really uncomfortable to put yourself first. It's like, oh no, this is, I think this is wrong. This is bad. This is selfish. Like, well, maybe. Living morally can be inconvenient. You know, those moments when you kind of go, yeah, I have to admit that I did that. I got to go to the boss or whatever. I got to pay back that money. Letting go is rarely as pretty as it sounds, you know, for real, you know. And fear often trumps faith in our stressful lives. None of this spiritual work is in any way exotic or impractical. It doesn't require suspension of our intellectual faculties. Really important to me, you know. I find it very frustrating when people think, oh, being spiritual, it's like kind of being a lightweight. It doesn't involve trekking the Himalayas to find a wise guru, walking on burning coals, or changing our wardrobe. What it does require is commitment and effort. Being spiritual can sound like some kind of airy New Age attitude, but I don't think it's that at all. I think that being spiritual is one of the biggest challenges we can take on in our lives, a kind of warrior's path. Neither passive nor impractical, spiritual life is the foundation for happiness and success. Ta-da. So, yeah, I mean, you didn't come here to hear me talk about how great I am, but yeah, that's a piece of writing that I appreciate. And you know, and it's helped me, frankly, you know, as I say, you know, this work is not something I do from the mountaintop, you know, passing down wisdom. It's my own exploration that I've been given the gift of being able to share, that people are, you know, take some interest. But the first result of it for me is that I write this and then I think about it and I understand my life better. And it actually provides me with guidance, as ridiculous as that might sound. I learned something when I wrote that, and it's helped me ever since to understand my own life and my own path. You know, and I think it points to the idea that the 12 steps and the 12 step path is much more than stopping taking the substance, you know, and that it's really a whole life journey that requires this commitment and involvement of every aspect of our life. And that's why, as we say, you know, the first step is about quitting and the other 11 are about staying quit. And then where does life go from there? What does it mean? Yeah, you know, and it is one of the it's one of the beautiful things about recovery that it opens up life in a way that might not get opened up if you weren't an addict. And it's why many of us say I'm a grateful alcoholic. You know, it's not something I usually say, but it is something that I feel that particularly the 12 steps, and then ultimately once I integrated them with my Buddhist practice, that stuff happened that wasn't going to happen in any other context. And had I not been an alcoholic, and, you know, and frankly, you know, I wrote this book really for the greater Dharma world, and they have not, it has not been embraced by the greater Dharma world. But I believe that a lot of the principles in here are things that could use further emphasis in the general Buddhist world, in the non-addict Buddhist world. And that's why I think that we have something that people who just come to Buddhism without this other piece that they miss. And I don't know, maybe that's some kind of, you know, you know, we are special because we're addicts sort of talk, which I don't care for. But anyway, I think there is an element of the gateway of addiction that brings us more deeply into the Dharma. So I've gone on for a long time, I see it. I invite you to join in. I see that there is a hand up, Jonathan in AB. Is that Albuquerque? Is that, where's that?
Calgary, Alberta, sir.
Alberta, all right. Very nice. I think I'll go out to Alberta. Da, 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 da. One of my favorite songs, Four Strong Winds. Maybe you know it.
For my time.
Yeah, definitely.
So, what's up? Yeah, I mean, like a little bit unrelated, but like the topic stirred this in me. So here we go. And like at the risk of, you know, blowing myself and everyone else up, as you said, I was thinking about like mudita practice and like the instructions that I've like historically received are like to be happy for someone's joy, regardless of why they're happy. And so like now my mind is wandered to like, so say to be topical, right? So like, I see a picture of Putin smiling broadly, conquering people, you know, something in that nature. Is it then like, so it feels like in a sense that I have to like suspend, kind of like what you were saying, like suspend my faculties then to have that experience of sympathetic joy for him. So is that like, is that skillful or is it just shutting my brain off, I guess is kind of where I'm going.
I don't believe that Vladimir Putin is happy.
I totally agree. But I mean, just even like in, like, I'm sure in a moment, like, you know, yeah, that's a fair point.
So I feel compassion for him. Mm. As well as hatred, but on, you know, my spiritual attitude is one of compassion because I believe that he is suffering immensely, and if I wish I believed more in reincarnation, because I would certainly believe that he was going to have some very bad times ahead, I mean, here I just think it's more a question of sort of being practical about it. Like, I don't think we're supposed to feel sympathetic joy for Vladimir Putin being happy that he's invaded Ukraine. I don't think that's quite what the Buddha is getting at.
So like maybe if I framed it with a different example, like, so like, say like I often, like I'll see like pictures of people that have just hunted and killed like a polar bear, which is, you know, not equally, but pretty not cool. And they're like, they're always super happy and I can see it. I can see the joy in their face. Like they're genuinely happy about what they've done.
So I think that mudita actually has something to do with karma though. That you are really, what you're taking joy in is the good karma that the person is experiencing, not just the mood that they're experiencing.
Okay.
And that then solves that problem.
Completely does. That's yes. Completely the answer right there. Thank you.
Right. Yeah. Thank you for asking, because I never would have thought of it that way, but now you forced me to figure it out.
beauty, reciprocal.
Yeah, thanks, Jonathan. It's a good, really good question. Thanks. Who's up next? Monica, you've got your hand up.
That was a good point. That and good question. You know, a good question there. I was just reminded that a while back now, I listened to Jack Kornfield on 10% Happier. And he pointed out that when we have unwholesome thoughts towards other people, that it poisons our own heart. You know, and that for me, that was like a transformative moment. Yep. So I just wanted to, that's it.
It's probably one of the reasons I'm depressed right now.
Oh, because you poisoned your heart?
Because I've got some poisonous thoughts going on. Yeah. Anyone else want to chime in?
Yeah, okay. Hi. So non-ill will. When I can't get to, you know, a deep Brahma Vihara place, non-ill will is really liberating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks, Vicki. Good point. A little easier than trying to build up some, you know, full loving kindness. So we're sort of officially at 11 o'clock. I'm going to hang out and we can go into the parking lot after Abraham and Anne. But anybody who needs to leave, thank you for coming. I'll be back here on Friday night, 7 p.m. Pacific. Yes, Abraham.
Hi.
Hi.
Abraham was in line first.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah,
you're next.
Thank you, Kevin. Just the last few comments were stimulating me. I happened to be on retreat with Gil Fronsdal 2 weeks ago. And of course, we had to integrate back into society after a week of silence. And, you know, he was trying to orient us. And, you know, the situation in Ukraine is still very horrible, and it's no different than it was the week before.
Yeah.
And so it was a kind of a downer to end the retreat, but he had a really nice, skillful way of, you know, what to do, what to do, what to do. And all I can come back to, if I want to be skillful, I think, is to center on the goodness in my heart and try and extend it to those around me, whether it's donating money to save the children in Ukraine or if it's being super pleasant to my neighbor. Wherever it is, I can't practically do something about the Ukraine, but I can't practically do something about being here and sharing this with you.
Yeah. Thank you. Absolutely. Starts there. Anne.
Yeah. Hi. It's good to be here. Sitting up. It's the first time I've sat up meditating since February 24th.
Yay. That's great. Yeah.
breathing has taken on a whole new level of awareness for me. I love that action. Taking action really, I think, helps in a situation where there is so much hatred and chaos and confusion. And also for me is turning it back on myself and like investigating a little bit, what's the hatred? What is that in me, right? That is projecting that outward onto to someone else who's doing horrific things, but to sort of turn back and say, okay, can I tend to that in my own heart? You know, that's what the practicing the Brahma Viharas has taught me, is that I don't think they exist, you know, sympathetic joy, mudita, I don't think, is my opinion, doesn't exist alone, you know, like there's karuna, you know, there's compassion, there's loving kindness, there's equanimity, you know. Anyway, it's a nice exploration. It's a difficult time for all of us. Yeah. So this is, you know, I'm thinking back the last 2 years. It's almost 2 years, or it is 2 years, right?
It is 2 years.
You started this.
Yeah.
And back for me, as maybe for a lot of us, it was a necessity, you know, it was a necessity to connect, to like be together in whatever way we could. And, you know, that you started this platform for all of us in this particular way. It has continued to be a necessity given the world situation.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, no, but it's become more than a necessity, right? It's, and then for me now, given my health issues, it's a touchstone, and I'm profoundly thankful that you have a lot of books to go through. And I love the passage, that spirituality passage. Mm. Yeah, really helpful. Thanks, Kevin. Thanks, everybody. Yeah. It's good to see people. I mean, thank you.
Yeah, I'm glad you're upright.
Yeah. Are we officially on the parking lot part portion? Shall I turn off the recording?
Yeah, why don't you? I think you can turn off the recording. Yeah.
Sorry.
Sherry, hi.
Hello.